The real essence of my message is that you can ill afford any longer to hide behind the great cliches of our church, like politics is dirty, that religion and government don't mix, and that the separation of church and state compels me to stand mute, because I want to tell you right now that politicians have become so professional that they know that you're inept in this field, and they don't fear your opinion. For example, we react almost daily now to determinations of polls about what people want, and we react much as a standpipe situation, and we know that of all of those who vote in the nation, bartenders probably reach 95%, Catholic priests in the 90%, and the Protestant people are somewhere in the neighborhood of 25%, and you Baptist ministers are lower than that. And we aren't communicating because we don't really invite a lot of investigation of our efforts and work, and you don't insist on the right to it. Now, I've changed my talk several times during this convention, and I've been terribly impressed with all of those who precede me. And I want to tell you, I'm going to break a record today. I'm going to be the only speaker who stays within the time limit to protect the flank that politicians are long-winded. But I'm going to talk about raw political power in just a minute. But I want to first set the stage by saying that in the last decade or 15 years, in the name of newness, in the name of newness, and upon the challenge of zero data, you and I and our two worlds have all but destroyed some basic concepts. And we're told that you preach in the pulpits from zero data. I presume that means the Bible. And you and I have listened to this challenge of the newness, and we have listened to the challenge of the dangers that exist in our day to mankind. And we have hastily reacted to this, to the almost near destruction of those great principles, not only upon which this nation was founded, but upon which our church was founded. And it hasn't been without a profound reaction. It hasn't been without a profound reaction. And from the field of government, I say, listen to all, but destroy precious basic concepts slowly. I remember a story when I was involved in the National Legislative Leaders Conference, and we were meeting with government officials at all levels. We were communicating, state and federal together, and we were concerned over a story that later came out in the Reader's Digest, and you may remember its challenging title, to give our young men something upon which to lean. And I rebelled at the idea that our great, tremendous youth needed anything to lean on, coming from the best of our churches and the best of our homes and the best of our school system. I resented anyone in government telling me that they needed anything to lean on. And the story, and I'm sure some of you have heard it at any rate, but it's impressive and to the point, and I want to deviate from my projected thought about the power of politics and how you may intervene and how you should intervene, to tell you this story, because it relates right to it. Our Navy found, as did all of the other branches, that they were suffering an unprecedented problem inside the service. And I use the Navy, and they use the Navy in this study, because they did not take into their ranks at that time, nor do they now, youngsters who had been involved in crime before they reached there. But they found that all of a sudden the crime rate inside the Navy and these youngsters, 18 and 19 year olds, had increased to a remarkable degree. They were beginning a general court-martial every 2 minutes of every day, of every business day. And they found that the confinement of these youngsters to the psychiatric wards of the Navy were increasing in remarkable proportions, and that at one time there were enough in there to man the entire submarine fleet of the Navy. And so on, every mark of a morale problem. And they selected ministers, outstanding ministers inside and outside the Navy, outstanding psychiatrists inside and outside the Navy, and they began to look to see why. Now, to keep this story from prohibiting me from keeping my word to you about my time limit, let me say that they come up with these conclusions, that our youngsters don't have any real fundamental belief in our concept of government. They don't have any real concept. They don't understand the difference between our concept of democratic government and that experienced in any other part of the world. So how can they fight for it? And they don't have any real fundamental belief in God or the existence of it. And this was happening about the time that some theologians, in the name of newness and in the name of change, were challenging the existence of a God, of a real living God. And let me tell you what they finally decided to do. Because I wouldn't accept any quicker than you would the right of anybody, including the Navy, to so seriously indict these youngsters. They began a simple process. To do it, they had to have a presidential proclamation, an order authorizing it. And they began to take the boys from our churches, from our schools, from our homes, and teach them a little bit about the precious constitutional concepts of a democratic form of government. Notwithstanding the fact that we had heralded to the peoples of the world that ours is a nation of law and not of men. But they had been hearing ministers say and politicians say that a law is good or bad, depending on whether you like it or not. And the slow and tedious processes of government are too cumbersome. They'd been hearing all sorts of other things. So they taught them a little bit about the concept of God and the concept of constitutional government. The reaction was, before the program was even over, to show you the effect of some sort of stability, some sort of reestablishment, redefinition of the very simple fundamental things on which, in which you work and in which I work in the field of government. These court-martials reduced over 70% the psychiatric confinements, somewhere over 50%. I've forgotten all of the statistics. But at least they were profound enough to point us back to the old maxim that what is past is prologue. Now, in the remaining few minutes, I want to tell you that the difference in our two worlds is that politics has power as its chief ingredient. It has compromise as a primary method of solution, and the public good as its main purpose. Now, you should not fear that I mention power as its primary ingredient. In many of the great debates in the halls of government, we're talking, first of all, maybe about some solution to a specific problem, but we're also talking about a political struggle. For example, in the halls of the Senate of Florida right now, we all began to pursue the question of how we could more effectively cope as a state with the question of crime and its continuing grapple for the control of business in the state. Well, now, all of us were after the same objective, and you might come in and say, yes, I'm for this bill. It might be the first one you see. One of them would place the power of this massive staff of governmental organization under the governor. I drafted and introduced one, and it spread and diffused this power among the state cabinet. Others had different approaches. Now, the legislature will probably take a little bit of the composite of all of those and come up with some crime bill. But the point is, the real struggle became quickly not whether we wanted to effectively deal with crime, a moral question to which you would certainly give your attention strongly, but a question of political power. Where expressed, how controlled. Now, the delicate challenge really that is presented to you is that your activity in this field, because it differs from all of the others that we've talked about on this wonderful occasion, it differs from entertainment and athletics. It differs from all of the other worlds to which a minister must address himself, because here we're talking about a delicate separation that has has torn the world in history. We've seen the day, and history tells us of the spectacle of the days when government was absolutely dominated by the church. There are other stories of that history reflects where the opposite is true. And here we have tried to establish the new unique constitutional concept of a delicate legal separation. It doesn't tell you not to come into the field of government, or that I should not come into the field of religion. It doesn't tell you that your responsibility as a Christian isn't to insist upon efficient and effective government. It simply says, and I believe one of the great Christian writers said it, it simply says, in effect, that the gears of the church should not automatically engage the cogs of government and vice versa. But under this shield, you have justified an absolute ineptitude and a physical departure from government to the point that we're almost ineffective in it. And when you do get into it, or some of your church members get into it, you don't get deeply enough to know the difference between the moral question involved and the political power struggle, and you almost always wind up being involved in a trap play and made to appear to be ridiculous. That it takes time to involve yourselves with government. And I want to invite you to look strongly at the field of government, because in all of the great areas to which all of these other speakers have addressed you to, the field of government is the executory arena. It's the area in which the compromise is made. It's the area in which the idea is produced into action. And it's the area in which, if you don't give some attention to, all of the other forces from which we daily hear will dictate the future of the relationship between the church and the state. Now, I'm not saying that when you come to the halls of government, you should leave God behind, because this is a tough business. It's a technical business. It's an area in which you mesh the different philosophical predilections of people representing all sorts of philosophies and all sorts of people, and they have every right to do it. But if you leave God in the church, as you come to the halls of government, all we'll have is more of what we now have too much of. But don't hang in the background on the basis that you're too busy, or that politics is too dirty, or that separation of church and state precludes your attendance in the halls of government, or your insistence upon your citizen right to participate. But when you begin to move, communicate. Find some single member of the council, city council at the local level, or the county commission, or find some member of the legislature. Communicate with him. Encourage your brother ministers to pick some other member in the political arena and communicate with him. Let me tell you that in this delicate day when politicians are trying so desperately to build beautiful castles to hold up to the constituency back home in justification for their return to office, they hear that this represents the majority will, and this represents the majority will, and they hear from this lobbyist and that lobbyist, and they offer all sorts of support at the polls next time, or opposition. And your voice just simply isn't heard. It isn't because you don't care. I know this. But you always reserve your right to protest and complain, and you should. But the right is a greater and richer experience if you've at least tried to change that about which you complain. I hope in the sessions that come, as we look around and hear the many voices representing the majority will, that the great Christian voice, the great Baptist voice, will be among those heard, and that the voice that we hear will represent a profound effort to be knowledgeable and a profound commitment to help. Thank you very much.